Welcome back to Lit City. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Anna Williams. And today we're going to begin our show in one of the most famous and historical literary hangout spots in Iowa City, Dave's Foxhead Pub, known to locals just as the Foxhead.
And if you were to pass by the Foxhead, you probably wouldn't even look twice. It is kind of a shotgun building with red siding and a stone foundation.
It kind of looks like a trailer or a train that's been permanently parked on the corner of Market and Gilbert Streets.
I think that describes it well. And inside this kind of grimy exterior, some of the greatest literary minds in our nation's history have gotten together to share some drinks and continue the conversations they started around the workshop table.
Famous people got drunk here, y'all.
That is another more succinct way to say that. They also did a lot of other things, too, as we will hear from this conversation with Lauren Haldeman. Today, we are sitting on the steps of the Foxhead in Iowa City with Lauren Haldeman. Again, she is a poet and a web developer for the City of Lit mobile app. And the Foxhead is one of the storied places. When you look at the history of the Writer's Workshop at the University of Iowa, it's not open right now. But tell me why this bar, among all the bars in Iowa City, and there are many, why this bar is the place to come?
Well, this bar has been the Writer's Bar for quite a while. This bar is so old that there are images from inside back when you had to stand to be able to continue drinking. You couldn't sit down, so bars had basically a standing bar where you could drink until you lost the ability to stand, and then you were cut off. Writers have been coming here for years and years. It's one of the stops usually after a workshop at the Iowa Writers Workshop. In between the Foxhead and George's, it switches back and forth which one's the poet bar and which one is the fiction bar. Although we can't count the number of different writers that have come here, we do know that Raymond Carver was here a lot, John Irving. We know that Hunter S. Thompson was even here on several visits, John Berryman. There are definitely rumors around the place about what has happened, who's been thrown out of windows, defenestrated.
Okay. I realize that these are unsubstantiated,
yes.
But you got to give us a couple.
Okay. I'll give the biggest one that I know of that I cannot find any, research-based proof on is that Hunter S. Thompson was actually 86th from here, kicked out for good after refusing to come back in with a beer on these very steps that we're doing this interview on. Wanted to drink outside, wanted to smoke outside, refused to come back in, and was kicked out for good. I haven't been able to track down any sort of, police report or whatnot, but that rumor is definitely out there.
I've got one for you.
Okay.
All right. So the big one that I've heard is that the Foxhead was the site where Kurt Vonnegut and John Updike got into some kind of disagreement, and Kurt Vonnegut ended up punching him in the face. Can you confirm or deny?
I cannot confirm nor deny that. But I know that there are so many stories of fights that have happened over the years, all of them involve being punched in the face. And I have seen my own firsthand fights in this bar, so who knows? But this is definitely a place where very heated arguments happen that are very often based in literature, based in the art of writing, and yet they're still can become like brawls,
Yeah. So if you're a literature super fan,
yes,
and you are visiting Iowa City because of the lore,
yes,
and you want to go into the Foxhead, is there anything you can see or any kind of experience you can have inside that might make you feel a little closer to some of these stories?
I think you should definitely visit the bathroom. it's been marked and marked again. The one thing you'll find is any bar that is full of writers, the bathroom walls are going to be like novels. They continue to try to paint over them, but they're tons of, written remarks, quotes, names on the ceiling, on the floor, and everywhere. Also, the actual booths have a certain patina to them that is layers and layers, almost a palimpsest of different writers having, you know, written their own name in the booth, written some sort of quote, or, you know, started a poem on the booth table or on the back of the booth. And those are still intact. I mean, and you can see the history there. You should also look for the actual fox head.
Right. I was going to say, there's actually, like, a really nice portrait of a fox head, too, that somebody, like, scratched into one of the booths in there.
Yeah, and there's actually a real fox head in there as well.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So is this the best location in Iowa City for literary graffiti?
Literary graffiti. Well, you know, downtown we have our controlled literary graffiti with the literary walk.
Yeah, we've been there.
Yes, we've been there. But I would say for non-controlled, non-public art-based graffiti, then yes, here in George's as well. But here is definitely seems like it's almost like a manuscript in itself, the way that the wood and the walls and, you know, also just sort of the layers of spirits in there. And spirits in many different forms.
Lauren, thank you so much.
Thanks.
That was Lauren Haldeman talking to us outside the Foxhead Pub in Iowa City.
We were talking with her about the traces some of these big-name authors from the workshop left behind, things like bathroom scrawlings, booth carvings, rumors of debauchery. And as it turns out, chasing after intriguing stories of the past is also the motivation behind Michelle Hoover's novel, Bottomland.
Although of a much different time period, she found an old family photograph that showed two young girls and found out about the story behind them. They supposedly disappeared. That was the family tale. That inspired her to write a novel imagining what might have happened to them. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
Let's talk about when you first saw this photograph, because this was a story that you didn't grow up hearing about. What happened? How did this come up?
So I was out visiting my aunt in California, and she had been very ill from cancer, though she was doing better. So I think she was my father's only sister, and so I was already kind of open emotionally for some discovery, and we were going through some old family photographs. And she showed me a photograph of my grandmother's family, and I never met my grandmother. She died when my father was in his 20s. And so most of these people I didn't know that I'd heard stories about, and I'm sure I met a few of them at one time or another when I was very young, but didn't have a very good memory of it. In the lower corner of the photograph were two young girls sitting next to a very stern-looking father figure. And my aunt told me that those two girls, or the rumor was that those two girls had disappeared from the family. And then she kind of just, I don't know, got up and got a piece of cake or something, like she didn't continue the story. So what I've gotten of the story is just bits and pieces and just confusing things, that this never actually happened, that the girls disappeared but both came home, that the girls disappeared and only one of them came home, or that neither one of them ever came home again. So I was really fascinated, and I couldn't get out of my mind their faces. And actually the faces of all the people in the photograph, and they all became instant kind of characters to me. And I just started to pursue that question, and that's the question that runs the novel as well. What happened to these girls?
And you have this photograph up on your website, and it's such an interesting photograph, because the family is, I guess, so well coiffed. I mean, everyone looks elegant and very well put together. And in your book, that was kind of a facade. Do you think it was a facade in real life?
I think that they kept up appearances and did what they had to do. They were a very practical family. But they had, they were farmers, and they lived a farming life. They weren't actually worse off than anyone else in their community in terms of how hard they had to work. They were actually doing pretty well, but when you were working a farming life back then, you were working from dawn to dusk. You did not stop, and you did not have anything extra, and you didn't have anything extra to waste. So they were dressed in their family best for that photograph. And and they look rather uncomfortable but also proud in that photograph. To me, it's just fascinating.
So did you... Then, obviously, this story started working on you immediately. But
yeah.
Did you try to research? Did you try to figure out what was true and what wasn't true? Or as a novelist, maybe that's not the important part of the story.
You know, I had the characters in my head so quickly that I felt myself resisting asking more questions. And my mother said that I should talk to people very quickly because the people that would know what happened were getting older. And that I should ask them questions. And I actually was on a panel of authors with the writer Simon Bauer, who's an English novelist. And I was talking to him about this problem and telling him about my resistance. And he said, well, don't ask. That will actually ruin the novel. You need to follow your imagination so that it becomes cohesive whole to what is happening on the page. And that's what I decided to do.
Was that a hard decision to make, though?
No, it wasn't. Well, no, because I'm very much a fiction writer. I have written some nonfiction, and even when I write nonfiction, I actually have a hard time. I start just going off into orbit and making things up, and I say, Michelle, you can't do this. But I was just so fascinated, and there were themes and ideas that I wanted to follow and figure out. Another part of the story is that my aunt had actually gotten a phone number for one of the women, for my great aunt Merle. And so supposedly the other side of the story was that Merle had never returned and the other sister had. And some people said that they remained in contact with each other and some people said no, that they didn't. Anyway, so my aunt found a phone number for my great aunt Merle, and apparently she was living under an entirely different name, first and last name. So for a woman to change her last name to her husband's name is not that strange, but for her to change her entire name, including first name, was rather odd. Yeah. So I knew something had happened. So my aunt tried to call her and a woman picked up the phone and said, no, you have the wrong number. And my aunt was a very tenacious sort of person, so she called again, and because she thought that she had the right number. And the woman said, yes, you have the right number, but she can't come to the phone right now. And she hung up. And then my aunt called again, and she said, yes, but she's very ill, and I'm her caregiver, and she really cannot come to the phone. But I'll give her your information, and she will call you when she's feeling better again. And then my aunt gave her her information and then hung up. My aunt never got a call back. And we have also lost that phone number. I think it was a letter or a journal, my aunt actually made a note that she believes that she was actually talking to my great aunt Merle on the phone, that the woman was in some way lying, was not the caregiver, but was actually Merle herself. Hmm. So that's the end point of the story. And so I thought, well, how does that happen? If you look at the photograph, Merle looks she's the blonde in the middle. She looks very submissive. She's leaning into her father. Her shoulders are hunched. She, looks like she would obey anything that people would tell her to do. And I kind of considered her kind of a very good girl.
Esther, on the other hand, delicate.
She looks very delicate. Esther, on the other hand, just looks like she's just going to do something. Like she just, you know, put a fly in your soup and she's waiting for you to find it or something. and so she was the older of the two girls. They were called the little girls in the family. And they were the two that disappeared, but it was Esther who came home. So why did the mischievous one, the so-called bad girl that was always causing trouble in the family, come home and the good girl didn't and wound up changing her name entirely and never making contact? So that, to me, was also fascinating. So I just wanted to follow that.
Yeah, and why don't you introduce us to your fictional family, now that we've talked a lot about your real family, there are lots and lots of overlaps here, but why don't you read a little bit for us from the beginning of the book?
Okay, so the book is five voices of the different family members. So the first to speak is Nan, and she's based off my grandmother. But again, all of these characterizations are highly fictionalized. And I actually, even when I talk about it, I begin to lose sense of what I created for the book and sense of what really happened. Anyway, so this is Nan. She starts off the book. It's 1920, just after World War One. The family lives in a very isolated farm in northern Iowa. They are a German-American family, and they have been ostracized from their community. And I can talk later about some things that were happening in Iowa at the time against German-Americans. But these are her first pages. It was little more than a month before winter shut us in when I last saw the youngest of my sisters, our little Merle. I woke to find her shivering just inside the front door when she should have long gone to bed. It was dark as a cellar in that hall, and outside it would be darker. Miles of field and grassland lay beyond the front porch. Our house sat alone on the prairie, far from its neighbors. The road to our place was a run of stubble and dirt. Merle's hair shone white on her shoulders, and she wore nothing but a nightgown. Her arms and feet bare in the cold, not enough sense to cover herself, though she was almost grown. I raised my lantern to her face. "Why, Merle," I said, "you'll catch your death." The look she gave as if startled out of sleep. Her eyes teared, and she ducked her head. The door was locked at her back. After the war, Father would have made sure of it. A draft rushed our ankles from the doorstep. The rest of the house was still, nothing but a wind outside knocking the stable gate. I touched Merle's forehead and felt it damp. She brushed away my hand. Her other hand she hid behind her hip, and when I asked her to show it, she glanced up the staircase and called our sister's name, as if Esther might rush down to save her. I turned my head, and Merle was off, the white of her nightgown a whirl up the stair. In their bedroom above, the two girls whispered together. When at last Esther stepped out, she looked down at me with her dark face, her hands very still where they gripped the rail. Without a word, she slipped back inside and drew the door shut behind her. Later that night, I would wake again and remember Merle as she stood in the hall. What noise had woken me a second time, I could not say. The hall had been cold when I'd found her, though her fingertips were colder. Her nightgown carried the smell of the riverbed. As she rushed away, I saw how her hair clung to her neck, her nightgown damp against her back, and the mat where she'd stood was dark with wet. When Merle was born, I too was just a teenager, but when first I held her, I believe nothing was so fearsome and astonishing as a child. All the many times we had watched her and chased her and held her fast, brushing her hair, tickling her feet, clutching her hands. As I lay in my room, I imagined again the heat of the flame as I'd held up my lantern. I saw how it burned close to Merle's cheeks until she flushed. I took the blanket from my bed, wrapped it around my shoulders, and stepped out into the hall. When I tried the front door, it was locked as it had been, but the hall was empty now. Not a sound came from the room above.
You mentioned the difficult position they were in as Germans in World War One in Iowa, and the family's last name was Hess. Is that an ancestral last name for you, too?
It is, though actually not on my father's side. So the family that this is based on, loosely based on, was not itself German-American. Okay. But that was a concern of mine. I didn't find out that I had German heritage on one, at least one side of my family until I was a late teenager, and I had a lot of trouble with it.
Really?
I had gone to Washington, D.C. doing a national history project on the Holocaust. And so the fact that I'm suddenly discovering that I'm part German American felt odd to me, and I was very uncomfortable with it and didn't claim it for a very long time. And so I was really interested in that kind of self-shaming that we carry. And I actually have come to terms with lots of ways in which my own personality is very German, I think. And so I wanted to deal with this family that's also German and place it in a time period in our history when German Americans were really ostracized from their communities and treated terribly, and kind of the shame that they themselves carry, the sense that they have done something terribly wrong, even if they haven't. And I just wanted to follow that.
So this family in your novel is in a rural area, obviously, outside of a very small town in northern Iowa. And I'm sure there are many people of German descent in Iowa. So they had some German neighbors as well, but you made them even more isolated than some of their other neighbors. What was at work there?
So the father he is very isolationist mindset. He didn't really want to live near anybody, and he doesn't particularly like to be with other people other than his family. He just wants to put his head down and work. And so it causes problems in the community. There were other members in the community when World War I was revving up that people changed their last names. Even before World War I came into the picture, people were altering their last names so they wouldn't sound as German. And people were no longer speaking as German as often, particularly as the war picked up. And the father refused to do that. He was kind of ignorant in terms of what was happening around him, and he was more obsessed with his land. And it was interesting because I didn't know, I thought, well, I'll place the novel around World War II because that's when German Americans had the most trouble. And it actually wasn't true. It was during World War I. And Iowa in particular, our Governor Harding in 1917 passed a law called the Babel Proclamation. And it went farther than any other state law in outlawing all foreign languages in support of our boys abroad, outlawing all foreign languages in both public and private spaces. So women were arrested in talking on party lines. People were arrested praying in graveyards over their loved ones. It was really severe. And actually, by the end of World War I, across the Midwest, 18,000 people had been arrested or fined for breaking such laws. So a lot of the German Americans kept quiet or they turned against themselves and each other. 50% of Iowa farmers at that time were German American descent. My family, the father figure, refuses to be quiet, refuses to hide his heritage, and it puts him into trouble.
The children also struggle with this because, of course, they've grown up in the United States, they've grown up in Iowa, and had friends, had relationships, and suddenly, perhaps a path that would have led to marriage, suddenly that's no longer an option. They're undesirable because of that German last name.
Yes. And that actually happens. So that happens to Nan most acutely. And a lot of that happens once the girls, after the mother of the family dies. She dies in the last few months of the war. And the girls are still really quite young, and they need a mother figure. So she decides that she needs to give up a life of her own to stay with the family and to raise these young girls. And then when they disappear, she just feels very betrayed, and she doesn't know what to do with herself. And she struggles with, well, what is mine now? What do I do with my life now?
One of the characters in the book, Lee, one of the brothers, went and served in World War I, which, of course, so many men of German descent in the United States did volunteer or were drafted and went to war. And there are parallels with every conflict. Obviously, in World War I and World War II, there were many German Americans who fought against the Germans in the war. But
yes.
It also has a parallel to what we see today when we see soldiers whose families come from Middle Eastern countries. They've served the United States. The Japanese Americans that served the United States, the Native Americans that served the United States. This is a pattern that happens with so many populations, so many ethnicities throughout the years. Was that something that you were thinking of with contemporary politics?
Oh, absolutely. Though, of course, it's gotten worse lately, and I didn't expect that or hope for that. And actually, the book came out on March 1st, which was the day for Massachusetts to vote on the candidates. So it was kind of all over the news. The same things that were happening against German Americans, the same feelings against German Americans, that distrust, the feeling that they were up to something, that they were going to betray us, that they would, you know, essentially stab you in your sleep, is happening today with Muslim Americans and other people that live in our society. In times of war, we just gain so much fear that we turn against ourselves. And it's really disappointing and sad. And I really hope that people remember our history, because at one time or another, it has hit every immigrant group, almost every immigrant group in the United States. And we need to remember that.
I'm talking with Michelle Hoover. Her second novel, which just came out, is called Bottom Land, and it's about a group of German Americans, a family living and farming in Iowa. Two teenage daughters in the family disappear overnight one night, and the story is told from a number of different perspectives. As you mentioned earlier, with five different voices in the book, we get to hear from the sister who has taken on the mother role, Nan, and we hear from the patriarch of the family. We hear from one of the brothers. We hear from Esther, and we hear from Merle. In writing in those different voices, what did you need to do as a writer to get inside the head of so many different characters and write from their perspectives?
It was difficult, to say the least, but I really believed in that point of view choice. I liken the house in the book as a set of boxes. So this family is, they're very isolated and they're very, really locked in. There's a lot of locked doors in the house. But they are all, even though they're shut in together, they're all highly isolated from each other, and they keep secrets from each other, and they don't really know each other all that well. So I built the book like a set of boxes, and each section of the book kind of unravels something new about the story and about the mystery of what happens. Nan's voice came rather easily to me. When I started the father's voice, I realized that, well, he has a heavy German accent. How do I do that without making it seem comical? So I don't actually speak German, but I did teach myself German syntax. And I aligned everything that I'd written in English, I aligned it into German syntax, which turned it into gobbledygook. And then I slowly normalized it, just to keep the slightest taste of that syntax. And I thought I'd actually normalized it too much and that wasn't even there anymore. But I have had people of German heritage and even people abroad saying that the father sounds very German. And so thank God for that. I think it worked. And then each voice had its own issues. Esther borrows a lot of the slang of the 20s, but that can also sound very jokey these days. So I couldn't let her do it too much. Lee has a very particular voice that came to me that I don't even know if I can describe it. He's just very much Lee.
Well, and reading from Lee's perspective, as a reader, you know, you always feel empathy for the characters, and Lee is so heartbreaking because he's so damaged from the war, and it's difficult as a reader to follow what's going on when Lee is talking, but that's because he also has a difficult time figuring out what's going on.
He jumps time. He can't always tell where he is.
Or what's real and what's not real.
And what's real and what's not. He was such an important character to me. And he was one of the changes that, one of the names that I didn't change. So based on my great uncle Lee, though I didn't know him at all, and apparently his character was entirely different. My father's name was also Lee, and I lost my father about 20 years ago. So I think all of my sympathies went into this character. And he's absolutely one of my favorites, but I knew that he was going to have trouble. So I just followed that.
In your last novel, your first novel, The Quickening, you again wrote about life in the Midwest. That was during the Depression. It was a very, very bleak book in a very bleak time. And this book also takes us to the Midwest, to the homesteaders. You do not romanticize this time or this kind of work in any way, shape, or form.
I had a bookseller say that it was kind of the anti-home on the prairie, which is fine. I mean, I think there's actually a lot of beauty in the landscape here and in that kind of work life, but it is very hard. And so I don't glaze over that. I've read a lot of journals and letters, particularly from farm wives, and kind of the isolation of it as well, particularly as a farm wife, that they had to undergo. And so I really wanted to break into that and reveal it to the reader.
Your first book was inspired by a journal left behind by your great-grandmother, right?
Yeah.
Is this
on my mother's side?
On your mother's side. And
yeah.
Then this book was inspired by a photograph and a story from your father's side of the family. So are there more skeletons in the closet that you can plumb for great novels in the future, Michelle?
Not yet. Not yet. I am working on a third book, and it's based on a real-life historical figure, and she grew up in Chicago, so it's not a family story. And so I'm kind of following that. I'm not talking a lot about who it was.
Can you give me a time period?
She was born in the 1890s.
Okay, so also a similar time period.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about this time in our history that captures your imagination so much?
It already has this wonderful context behind it. It gives everything so much more importance to me. I also can't imagine writing a book that has cell phones or text messages or, I don't even have very many cars in my books. I mean, it's just, I don't know. Even though I use that stuff, I live in a city, you know, I have a phone in my hand all the time. But this Bottomland is considered a literary mystery. And I thought, well, it wouldn't even be mysterious if they could just call home. And, you know, what? How boring is that? So I don't know. And I also really am attracted to conveying work and real work where people get down and dirty, and just conveying a time that just that kind of isolated time where people had to really choose between, am I going to make something of my own life? In order to do that, I have to risk a great deal. Or am I going to stay and be dutiful to the family? So I think all my books have been working in that way. And for women, particularly at the time, to strike out on their own and have lives of their own was very risky, was very dangerous. And I love trying to follow that and giving them that freedom.
That was Michelle Hoover talking to me back in April of last year about her novel, Bottomland. And for me, I am an Iowan of German descent, so this story really connected me with some of my roots. And I think a lot of other Iowans find that it speaks to them the same way. In fact, it speaks so loudly that it has been chosen as the All Iowa Reads novel for the entire state of Iowa this year. So I think a lot of people will be exploring that part of our past when there were all of these different immigrant groups and tensions arose, and maybe making some connections to the present as well.
Right, right. Okay. So, Charity, this is, to use a literary term, our penultimate episode of Lit City, which is a fancy way of saying second to last.
Second to last episode of season one of Lit City. But since we're being fancy, let's be thorough, too. Penultimate means more than just second to last, right?
It does. Usually the penultimate chapter in a book or the penultimate act in a play sets the reader or the viewer up for the resolution. And in a way, next week's episode will really tie things up neatly for us here in Lit City.
Because on the next episode, we're going to talk about how places shaped culture and literature, and in fact, a very, very important piece of literature. We will be talking about the book, The Cities That Built the Bible, with the author Robert Cargill. And trust me, it will be fascinating.
Thanks for stopping by Lit City.
See you next time.